This is an ABC podcast.
Blue skies and fluffy white clouds, the biting freeze of an Arctic blizzard, wild, maddening tropical heat. Hello, I'm Kate Evans, and this is RN's monthly book club edition of The Bookshelf, where we focus on a particular author or a literary idea. And today, Cassie McCullough, it's an episode entirely devoted to the theme of weather.
Indeed, Kate Evans, and welcome back after a few weeks away. It's good to see you. And yes, the extremes and the in-betweens of the natural world as seen through writerly eyes.
Yes, I had to bail out because of unexpected storms. Thanks for keeping that ship afloat, Cassie. It's good to be back for this excursion into weather and how and why there's so much of it in the books we read, both old and new. And we've asked two bright stars of contemporary Australian writing to take this journey with us.
Two authors who share an interest in the natural world, which is evident in their work. Robbie Arnott, whose most recent book is the achingly beautiful Limberlost, about one boy's life over the course of a Tasmanian summer in the 1940s. The book he's selected for us today, though, is 1993's The Shipping News by Annie Prue.
Also joining us, Hannah Kent, whose latest novel, Devotion, takes us from the cool forests of Prussia to the wild South Australian frontier. She's chosen 2021's Small Things Like These by the Irish writer Claire Keegan.
And we've also chosen a couple of books with weather at their heart. I'm bringing one of my old favourites to the table, one from the late Australian writer Andrew McGahn, called 1988.
And I'm putting on the table the recently released novel The Weather Woman by the British writer Sally Gardner. But before we do anything else, to your thoughts on weather in literary fiction and the many contributions on our ABC Book Club Facebook groups.
Yeah, so many great thoughts on this. Here's a few. Helen Neal says, it's a bit of an oldie, but I almost had to put a jacket on while reading Snow Falling on Cedars by David Goodison. The word pictures of the intense cold in that courtroom are brilliant.
And I remember Michael Rowbotham told us, Cassie, that that's one of his favourite books of all time. But Brenna Brown suggested The Leopard for scorching heat, dust, the winds of change and beautiful Sicily. And we read Lampedusa's 1958 novel together when we were talking Italian fiction a few years ago.
Yeah, for another book club edition. Sue Mears says, I'll never forget reading the opening of The God of Small Things on the equator in Indonesia. May in Ea Memnon is a hot, brooding month. The days are long and humid. The river shrinks and black crows gorge on bright mangoes in still, dust-green trees. Red bananas ripen.
Well, from Arundhati Roy, we now turn to John Steinbeck. And Susie Ramone said, The Grapes of Wrath reveals the desperation of trying to survive in the Dust Bowl during a really bad drought in the US during the Great Depression. And Nikki Tasker added that with that book, she could see tumbleweeds rolling along the highway.
Yes, there are a couple of other suggestions about that period in US history, that dreadful, dreadful drought. And speaking of drought, there are also loads of Australian book suggestions on the ABC Book Club Facebook group. Carolyn Quillen nominated The Lost Man and The Dry by Jane Harper. And I think Linda Lawrence also nominated Treasure and Dirt by Chris Hammer. And I'll add Scrublands to that, which is, I think, even drier than The Dry, Kate.
From memory, it was hot.
It was very hot.
Always hot. Linda Pooley also wanted to recommend The Blue Plateau by Mark Tredinnick, saying it's gorgeously written with descriptions of the Blue Mountains in fire, flood and everything in between.
Mm-hmm. Adrian Robertson recommended the recent Echolalia by Bryony Doyle, which is an Australian book with a climate change theme. And there are a few of those now, aren't there?
There are, and I think that's another theme that will linger throughout our conversation today. Amelia O'Reilly said, I was lucky to read an advanced copy of Fed to Red Birds, which we'll be talking about today, Amelia, and I thought it was lovely. The way the Icelandic landscape and weather was written was stark but relaxing at the same time.
Yes, now this is by an Australian author, a debut novel. Her name is Rain Collins, and it's set between Iceland and Melbourne. So we're going to discuss discuss that with Hannah and Robbie today. Also, Marie Bowman said Mr. Wig by Inga Simpson, with the rhythm of the seasons, such a key feature of this beautiful book. And a lot of Inga Simpson's books are deeply embedded in nature.
Yes, she's a beautiful writer. And also The Islands by Emily Brugman was suggested. The ever-changing seas and skies, the seasons and the contrast of the climate with Nordic cold weather and traditions, they all feature.
Yeah, we loved that book, didn't we? And Regan Stevenson is also putting a hand up for 1988, which is my choice. I still think of it frequently years later, especially in the wet season. Me too. I can't wait to talk about that one.
And Pat Kershaw and Sue Kowinski, among others, talked about Tim Winton's writing. Tim Winton, without a doubt, thinking particularly of the landscape etched from the effects of weather in The Shepherd's Hut. In fact, all his musings on the landscape and the sea, which any West Australian views with him quite often through the lens. See more of him. And Sue Kowinski also added that for scorching heat, that novel, The Shepherd's Hut, she said, I had to stop reading. It was so intense.
I thought of it too. Yes, some brilliant evocations of weather in all of those suggestions. Thank you very much for that. If you want to add something, you can always go to the ABC Book Club Facebook group where there's really a lively conversation. How many members, Kate?
60,000 and counting.
Yeah, heaps. Well, let's meet today's guests. In 2013, Hannah Kent scored the literary equivalent of a hole-in-one with her 2013 debut novel, which became an international bestseller and was translated into more than 30 languages. Burial Rites tells the story of the last woman to be executed in Iceland, Agnes Magnusdotter, who was beheaded in 1830. The movie rights have been optioned. The Hollywood actress Jennifer Lawrence's name is attached, as they say in Hollywood. And since then, Kate, she's gone on to write more.
Yes, Hannah's written two more novels, which also take place between 1820 and 1830. The Good People, set in Ireland, and then last year, The Love Story, Devotion, which takes us from an old Lutheran community in Prussia to a settler, South Australia. Hannah, hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's a delight to talk to you again, Hannah. It always is. Now, you're also a screenwriter and you've recently returned from the Sundance Festival, so cool, where Run, Rabbit, Run screened. This is a film that you wrote, which is actually coming to Netflix soon. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it is. It was, I mean, going to Sundance was just... Talking about weather, I've never seen so much snow in my life. It's been an amazing journey. It's something I completely fell into. I was given an opportunity to collaborate on a feature film and develop the idea with Carver Films, who are based in Melbourne. And, it's completely out of my wheelhouse as a historical novelist. It's a contemporary psychological horror film about a mother whose daughter starts acting very strangely, starring Sarah Snook and directed by the wonderful Dana Reid. It's been wonderful to sort of have a go at something a little bit different and to, you know, stretch my legs in a different genre. And, yeah, completely different writing for film, as I've learned, compared to novels. Much more of a sprint than the marathon that a book is.
Yes, a different discipline entirely. And I'm also aware that The Good People is under option by a film company and you're writing the script for that. And also Devotion has been optioned by Rose Byrne's company, Dollhouse Pictures.
Yeah, that's right. So, no, it's been again, something I've completely happily fallen into, not planned at all, but adapting your own work is, again, just that little bit different from coming up with that, you know, an original idea. But it's something that I think, you know, having been drawn to so many true crime, to true events from history, it's, to me, it feels just like another way to approach that same story and to interpret it differently for screen. So, yeah, it's been really, really enjoyable, actually, learning more about that industry.
But, Hannah, can I get back to what you described as your wheelhouse, which is writing historical fiction? I'm always interested in that balance between good research and imaginative flights when people write historical fiction. And I'm wondering how hard is it as a writer to weigh up the texture and detail that you need with the demands of storytelling?
It's such a tricky thing, isn't it, with historical writing? It's something I think about a lot because when I read historical fiction, I think if there is sort of a superfluous amount of information or detail, it's something I recognise immediately. And it can be really grating for a lot of readers. I think for me, I've tried to adapt my research process and my writing process to accommodate it. I sort of rely on my terrible memory in that I research really hard for about a year and I try to absorb as much information and knowledge and facts as possible. And then I leave the books behind so that when I'm writing with that focus on character and place and landscape, only that which is immediately relevant to the plot or to the character sort of seeps through and everything else just kind of falls by the wayside. But I know lots of people have very different methods.
Thank you so much for that. I'm often struck by those books when you can and you can't see the pile of research folders sitting next to the book. But also with us is Robbie Arnott.
Yes. Now, last week, Kate, I said that Robbie Arnott is developing a cult following for his strange and beautiful books. Well, it's no secret that I'm in that cult. In fact, last year I declared Limberlost, this beautiful story of a young boy living in rural Tasmania in the Second World War, as my book of the year. I just loved it so much.
Well, you're not alone, Cassie. And we also discussed The Rain Heron from 2020, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Literary Award, and Flames from 2018, which won a Tasmanian Premier's Literary Prize. And Robbie is joining us from Hobart. Hello.
Hi, Kate, and hi, Cassie, and hi, Hannah. It's great to be here.
And Hannah, we should say, is joining us from Adelaide, so we're really crossing the continent today. Now, Robbie, a lot of your craft, I understand, in writing comes from your other job. You work part-time in an advertising agency as a copywriter, and you've been in that field for about 10 years. Tell us what it's like. It must be quite brutal having the words that you've chosen, that you've crafted, going through the ringer of the industry that you work in.
I mean, I guess it is, yeah, but it also helps you develop a really thick skin. So I was a copywriter in an agency before I was a novelist. So now what's just really set me up for is that reviews and feedback just doesn't really worry me in the literary world because I'm used to people saying 100 times worse things every single day at work. I remember when I was about 23 and working as a junior copywriter in Melbourne, all I was doing was writing headlines for Officeworks catalogues. And I'd be working back late and my boss would be saying, "Hope you haven't got any plans tonight because this is all rubbish." And, you know, that was just your life. Yeah. So now when I talk to my editor, he says, "Oh, look, I'm not quite sure about this phrase. Perhaps we could look at it again." You know, to me, that's just someone being really nice.
Yeah, yeah. Give it to me straight up, mate.
Yeah, so yeah, there is that. But also, there's not really any similarities in craft between that work and writing novels. They actually feel very different, but it does really build up your resilience and your work ethic, I guess. So that's really what it's given me more than anything.
So discipline and rigour with deadlines, writing to word length and crafting writing. But this feedback thing, it sounds harsh, but also it teaches you not to be too precious, is what we're hearing. But what are some of the, I mean, has someone ever said something to you that's cracked something open about language and writing for you?
I really always like that old Kafka quote about a novel should be an axe for the frozen sea within you. That's something I always think about, that you want a piece of fiction or at least literary fiction to be an almost revelatory experience for a reader, to have it kind of knocking around in their chest as they walk about the day after they've read it.
Just say that again. A novel should be an axe
for the frozen sea within you.
Oh, wow. Okay. The bursts that open.
Yeah, I hope I'm not trying to sound clever there. That's a very old quote.
No, I love it. I'm writing it down.
But no, in terms of like my day job, nothing. It's just kind of guys in suits shouting at me and they can barely write an email. So, you know, it's quite different.
Hello to Robbie's employers, if they're listening.
But you're in good company, aren't you? Because Peter Carey and Heather Rose, both also advertising copywriters who are also very good literary fiction writers.
And, of course, Bryce Courtney.
Yeah, of course. Must be on the same bookshelf.
Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut and a few others.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Whenever nice. I feel bad about my day, I think about that.
But Robbie, your novel Limberlost took us to a particular Tasmanian summer, whereas The Rain Heron was set in more of an indeterminate place, although it did have at least one Tassie species of gum tree in it. So I'm wondering whether you see your writing as tied to place, to where you are.
I think each story is very specifically tied to place, and I start with a landscape or a place when I start writing, and then the story and characters really come from there. But I don't necessarily see it tied specifically to, say, Tasmania, for example. It depends whatever the story needs and wherever it's come from, either it's imaginative or it's real. Once that's established, then the story is really anchored to that. But no, I don't sit around thinking that, oh, I have to write about a certain part of Tasmania because that's next on the list.
Well, let's talk more about both of your writing and weather in it. Hannah Kent, there's lots of weather in your books. Why is that?
Oh, look, you could arguably say there's too much. I think it's probably just comes down to a couple of things. Probably primarily, I just really love writing weather. I love writing nature. There's a particular joy that comes from the difficulty of trying to capture something which defies easy articulation, I guess. And that's how I see landscape. But also, I do write books set in a time where people were not quite so dislocated from the natural world as arguably, again, we are now. You know, we have artificial light and heating and cooling, and I'm writing about a time where people didn't have these things. So for me, it seems very natural to make the weather something, an intimate part of my characters' lives, you know, whether it be the cold or the seasons and the way in which they, you know, it influences their day-to-day life. Often I write about people who come from a poor or agrarian background. On one hand, it just feels like something I have to do as a historical novelist. It's about due diligence as a researcher and a writer. But also on the other hand, I just really, really, really love reading and therefore writing the natural world. It's my favourite aspect of it, I guess.
Yes, there's a moment in the first half of Devotion, your third book, that I've come back to a few times, and that's where the weather's turned cold and one of the characters is forced to go door to door begging from neighbours who also have limited resources. And I just thought of how common that must have been, and you know, my own family ancestors would have had to have done that, no doubt. It's something that thankfully we mostly don't encounter in our lives, in Australia at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so much of Devotion was written with my grandmother in mind, who was someone who lived very closely with the elements. You know, there was a period of time where she was sleeping outside. And she was, I've never met anyone else who was so easily able to read the world. I mean, she would always know when it was going to rain. And she would teach me things, you know, the movements of animals and so forth. And I think there's many of us who have lost that kind of connection and that kind of understanding. So it's a really lovely thing to return to in fiction, to sort of bring back that kind of knowledge and celebrate it by writing about it.
Well, let's go to you, Robbie Arnott. There's also a lot of weather in your writing. It's this quite major presence in Limberlost, but it's so subtly woven into the narrative, I think many readers may not have noticed. Describe the seasonal arc in that book.
Yeah, so much of the book is set across one summer in the 1940s, and particularly how the main character Ned is reacting to it, and that the arc of that novel really takes you from the start to the end of that summer. And so, for example, at the start of it, it's quite warm, but very doesn't really stop anyone doing anything. It's hot, but everyone's getting on with things. But as we progress, and it almost as the tension of the novel cranks up, it starts getting hotter because, you know, that's what happens. And everyone starts struggling. Animals start struggling. People start struggling. And it's only towards the end of the novel where the narrative comes to a close that summer breaks and autumn comes in. And that, yeah, it really influenced the way I wrote it because I always wanted it to be set across this one season. Mm-hmm. I had this weird thing I've ended up doing that is not deliberate, that in winter I write about summer and in summer I write about winter. And very rarely do I write about the season it is actually outside the window. I don't know why that is. It seems to be the way. I'm often by the coast on a hot January day and I'll be writing about a snowstorm. I wish I knew why, but it just seems to be what's happening.
One day you'll have to catch up with the Irish-Australian writer, Dervla McTiernan, whose novels are often set in Ireland, and so she has to, in her West Australian home, close all the windows and put the air conditioning on as low as she can so that she can recreate for herself what Ireland's like. But, you know, yes, the peak of the summer in the book is, I'll just read a little bit for people here. All the creeks were dry, the troughs parched, the ponds empty. Moisture had steamed off even the moss. Rain was needed, but none came. Possums fell from the trees, wallabies folded into piles of heavy fur. All this hot flesh summoned scavengers. The nights rang with the screams of feeding devils, and the daylight skies were dotted with hawks, more appearing each day, scanning the valley for summer's latest victim. You really evoke an Australian summer there so beautifully. What does weather do? I mean, in terms of a character and the forward motion of a novel, why is weather a useful device?
Look, in a really practical way, I find weather really helpful because it's something we all have to react to every day. I mean, there's probably not that many people who get up and don't check the bomb on their phone or their desktop anymore. And it's a really useful tool, I find, to get my characters moving and to get the story kicking along. So not so much a large metaphorical term, but really just to get things going, because it's really hard sometimes to think, well, I know where I want my characters to go and I know where I want the story to go, but in the nuts and bolts of it, how do I get there? And often if it's a rainy day outside, that will dictate how they behave. And if it's actually a really sunny, bright day, you can figure out how they react to that. So this is just a purely nuts and bolts thing, but weather I find really helpful like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't think it's just nuts and bolts. I always love it when a book makes me thirsty or makes me sweat a bit, or when I can smell those rotting animals. And I think you managed to do all of that, Robbie. But I'm curious, though, about the way that in The Rain Heron you chose to embody the weather. So to capture the rain in the wings of a bird, which I found just such an extraordinary image, and the way that it flew throughout that whole novel. So that's doing something different with the weather. What did it mean to you to embody the rain in a bird?
I've always been very interested in creation myths from all around the world, and part of that novel was I wanted to try and make one of my own and see if it was possible. And creation myths are really often linked to the weather and the forming of the world, and there's often floods and storms and fires and things like that that explain how the world came to be. So as I was thinking about this, I realised I wanted to create a really cataclysmic weather event in the form of an animal, and I realised I wanted to write about a storm. And it just made sense to me that that storm was a bird, because that's the most natural animal for a storm to be, at least to my mind. And I set about building it from there, and there were many different drafts and many different versions, but it came to me as the rain heron. And that's probably the easiest way I can explain it. My mind probably doesn't work too normally when it comes to these things. I don't really know how it happens, but it came out that way.
Oh, Beth, Kate and I are sitting here smiling hearing you describe that, because we love that book so much. Wonderful. And, of course, your first book, Flames, has extreme weather in it. There's a rainstorm in that, but also floods and fire. So it's really part of what you do on page, Robbie.
Yeah, it really connects back to something Hannah was saying, which I really liked about having people's connection to landscape being something I like writing about, much the way she does. And weather is such a great way to show that relationship between characters and environment. And it's almost a quick way to get them in there.
And we could have called this book club A Story About Storms, because there are storms crashing through both of your books.
There sure are. Well, let's turn to the books that we're all bringing to this discussion of weather. And we'll start with Hannah's choice, Small Things Like These.
Irish writer Claire Keegan, whose short story Foster was the basis for last year's award-winning Irish language film The Quiet Girl, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize last year for her novella Small Things Like These, a book that left me staring at the wall in shock when I finished it.
And Kate, as it happens, you'll be interviewing her as part of the Sydney Writers Festival in early May, and apparently that's already sold out, so a lot of people love this work as well. Hannah, take us into this novel. Where are we and when?
Well, Small Things Like These is set in 1985, and its protagonist is Bill Furlong, who is a coal and timber merchant in an Irish town, who in the lead up to Christmas, amidst his busiest season of deliveries, a high demand for fuel for everyone to keep warm, is sort of accidentally and then intentionally brought face to face with the cruelties of Ireland's Magdalen Laundries. It's a tricky book to talk about, though, in terms of plot. For one thing, it's very, very short. It only sits at around 100 pages. And to talk about it solely in terms of the events that happened doesn't really do the book justice. I think small things like these is basically the closest thing to a perfect book I've read in many years. I was the same as you. I was just completely blown away by it. And I think what really sets it apart and makes it so exquisite is the prose. The beauty of Claire Keegan's language is just completely out of this world. It is at once so intensely precise and yet also measured and lyrical all at once. I think it's such a hard thing to do, particularly in a book which really you could argue is a novella. But I absolutely loved it. It is at once tender, at once filled with human kindness and goodness, and yet, on the other hand, doesn't hold any punches when it comes to articulating the devastation done by the Magdalen Laundries and the cruelties done to countless women and children. Yeah.
And some of that cruelty, Hannah, we feel because of the cold, don't we? I mean, it's close to winter. It's so cold that when the protagonist is going to deliver his fuel, he has to borrow boiling water to pour over a padlock so that the padlock will open. So the cold, cold cruelty of the Catholic Church and what is being done in these laundries is something we feel deep in our bones, don't we?
Yeah, it's so clever because on one hand, having this sort of this description of intensifying cold and snow coming and Christmas coming creates quite a cozy sense amongst the village. You know, people are sort of bunkering down, they're making Christmas cakes and mince pies and things like that. And yet, on the other hand, it also speaks on an allegorical or metaphorical sort of level to the way in which, I guess, the antipathy of the villagers to the outside harsher realities that are existing on the periphery of the village. You know, there they are in their snug warmth, wrapped up in their own self-interest, and yet completely willing to ignore that which is happening right, you know, on their doorsteps. And I thought that was a really clever way to do so. On one hand, to create this sense of warmth and coziness and this sort of, you know, familial celebration, which has so much to do with the weather at that time of year, but also on the other hand, to sort of use the weather again, you know, when you go out into it, when you are out there in the dark with the coming snow, to, I guess, point to those cruelties which are occurring just you know, just beyond that sort of warm glowing light of the Christmas season of the village.
The high contrast of those binary opposites. And I guess we should explain what Magdalen Laundries were for people who haven't come across that term. It's for unmarried mothers. They were press ganged into basically slave labour in these wash houses while they awaited the arrival of their child, and then some of them even stayed there after because they were destitute because of the incredible cruelty, I guess.
And often those babies were taken away from them, which is part of the context. And also the shock of it that this novel was set in 1985 and they were still in existence then and continued after that. But Robbie Arnott, I think you've also read this book. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I love this book. I was so glad when I heard Hannah picked it. It really blew me away. And I agree that it's just so tautly and finely constructed, but also completely beautiful. And I didn't know anything about the Magdalen Laundries when I came into it. I didn't know what the subject of the text was. So when that revelation came throughout the book, I didn't see it coming, really. I got the sense of foreboding, but I just agree that her prose is so beautiful and spare yet moving. And I think I lent this book to about four people last year. My book of the year.
Oh, wow. Oh, really? Okay. That's amazing.
And so yet another Irish novel in which a writer confronts that nation's history and its cruelty and raises painful ethical questions as well, and does it so beautifully. I mean, in a way, it's showing what it is that fiction can do.
Mm.
And in this case, it can be a cold, cold world.
Yes, and in fact, I was just talking to Sebastian Barry, the Irish writer whose most recent book, Old God's Time, is about exactly that. It's a very deep wound in the Irish soul, that one.
And so, Hannah, as we're talking about Claire Keegan's novel, is there a reading from it that you'd like to give us to give a sense of that writing you were talking about?
Yeah, I have a very brief one, but it's brief but perfect, I think, and gives a sense of both the weather and also how it speaks to, I guess, the Bill Furlong state of mind. Outside, the streets were slick with frost, and his boots on the pavement sounded unusually loud, it being so early on a Sunday. When he reached the yard gate and found the padlock seized with frost, he felt the strain of being alive and wished he had stayed in bed. But he made himself carry on and crossed to a neighbour's house whose light was on.
That is just lovely. Thank you. There's so much about that book that just left me sort of frozen in my seat. This is a book club edition of The Bookshelf on Radio National and via podcast. I'm Kate Evans, here with Cassie McCullough, and we're discussing how weather appears as a universal literary theme and device. And our guests today, authors Hannah Kent and Robbie Arnott.
And now to Robbie's selection for this investigation of weather in literature, The Shipping News by US author Annie Proulx. It was her second novel. It won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for Fiction. And you'll probably know her short story, Brokeback Mountain, which was adapted as the 2005 film. It starred our Heath Ledger. And it went on to win a whole lot of awards as well. But The Shipping News was what really broke her through, Kate.
Yes, it was her second novel, I think. It tells the story of Coyle, a man who's had a bad run of luck, a very extraordinarily bad run of luck, and he ends up living back in his family's ancestral home in Newfoundland, a large island off the North American mainland, but which formed a union with Canada in 1949. It has a distinct sort of identity. But Robbie, tell us about when you first read this book.
I think I was in my early 20s when I first read this book, and I came to Annie Proulx through her short stories. Someone lent me a copy of, I think, Wyoming Stories, one of her collections, and just really knocked my socks off. She's such a wonderful writer and so kind of harsh and devastating, yet insightful, and all paired with this beautiful landscape writing at all times, which is always present in her work. And it's completely unflinching in the way she looks at the world. And I've just been a big fan ever since. I think she's incredible. And yeah, this is one of my favourite books. Every page kind of feels like it's cracking with the ice in the bays at Newfoundland, and everything feels frosty, and it's that feeling like you want to go have some warm soup after you've read a chapter. It's such a frost-tingling book. And yeah, I just love it. And everything Coyle goes through and his family goes through is incredibly moving. It's best not to talk about the movie with Kevin Spacey and Julianne Moore, but the book itself is just really terrific.
You know, like, this is one of those books that I never managed to get into. I sort of ran up to it a number of times and gave it a good go, but it never really took off. But when I'm looking at what the plot involves, it's hard to, I mean, it's a run of bad luck that Coyle has that's really kind of hard not to find comic when you lay it out. He's this newspaper reporter. His parents have, I mean, it's not funny at all. They've killed themselves in a joint suicide pact. His unfaithful, abusive wife leaves town with her lover and tries to sell their daughters to sex traffickers. I mean, it's just, when they try to get away, there's a car accident. I mean, how does this not become a comic novel?
Yeah, it's funny when you dot point a plot like that. It does sound like absurd, but when Annie Proulx does it, it works. And that's probably the best thing I can say about it. She just writes so incisively and insightfully about Coyle and his life that we do feel very sorry for him, but we're so drawn to the kind of minor variations in his character that draw him towards Newfoundland. And even, for example, in his parents dying, his dad hated him and he hated his dad. So while it's this kind of horrible fact, it almost frees him in a way from the yoke of tyranny of his father. And his relationship with his wife is very one way as well. He loves her, but she treats him terribly. So in another way, he's almost set free. And that is really what is the impetus of the novel. And yes, I totally agree that the dot points of the plot are pretty horrific. But it opens it up for this great sense of discovery that Coyle goes through when he goes and reconnects with his ancestral homeland. And, you know, spoilers ahead, then it's not a nice story there either. It's still pretty horrible. But the way their family is kind of drawn together, particularly his relationship with his aunt on Newfoundland, really just creates this huge sense of warmth and discovery in a small way within their family that is really moving to read.
And Robbie, like Cassie, this was one of these novels so influential, so many people I knew loved it, and I was always somehow intimidated by it, and it's always been one of my reading shames. So I only finally read it this week, and after that blisteringly painful beginning, we're then in the house garlanded with wind, and there's such a strong sense of the sea breathing down your neck in this one, and of the weather swirling around it. So I wonder if you could take us into her writing by reading something from it.
Yeah, she's just writes landscape and weather so beautifully. So this is just from a description of an evening, but the sky was not red, but almost black in the southwest. Storms on the way. Soon enough, there would be frost on the glass, frost fur on the seals, the edging of frost that gathered on the quilt where the breath condensed, the timbers of the house contracting in the Arctic nights with explosive creakings and snappings, and outside the ravenous wind in the cables, slamming down the chimney and sending rims of smoke up around the stove lids. The raw misery of February.
Oh, wow.
And I love that there's a lot of the description of the weather in this actually comes through characters. There's a lot of dialogue in this novel, and there's a lot of, you know, kind of larger-than-life characters living in Newfoundland, and particularly the editor of the newspaper where Coyle works is always complaining about the cold and the weather, and he has some classic lines, like when he says, you know, if you make it to March, you'll make it to heaven, son, and things like that. It just really stick with you.
Oh, that's so good. What about you, Hannah? Are you a fan of Annie Proulx?
Oh, my gosh, I'm the biggest fan. I've had to restrain myself all throughout this time to not just to interject with lots of sort of affirmations. I'm so thrilled that Robbie picked this book. It's one of my favourite. In fact, I was so openly obsessed. I thought I wasn't. I thought I was keeping it together. But I was so openly obsessed with Annie Proulx that once I received a creative writing assignment back from a uni tutor who just said, "Fan of Annie Proulx much?" Question mark. So, you know, she taught me a lot. But yeah, I'm a huge fan. And I think for the same reasons that Robbie has so beautifully said, you know, she landscape is always a character in her books, and she writes it so well. It's so evocative. You are there, you know, you're wiping the dust out of your nostrils, or you are going to go get another jumper because you can feel your toes freezing. And the way in which too she so gently maneuvers her characters throughout the natural world, throughout weather, is something that she does just so beautifully and eloquently and movingly too. I find her works really, really moving. I think because they are also quite restrained. I think I find something in her prose as lyrical as it can be to be quite restrained. And there's so much which she entrusts the reader with in terms of imagination.
Cassie, let's turn to your selection, which is 1988 by the Australian writer Andrew McGann, who died from pancreatic cancer in 2019, aged just 52, sadly. And in 1991, his first novel, Praise, won the Vogel Award, and his fourth, The White Earth, won the 2005 Miles Franklin. So all told, he wrote seven novels, as well as a number of things for the stage. But Cassie, where then does his novel, 1988, fit in?
Yes. Look, I'm giving myself away as totally Gen X here, but Praise obviously took everyone by storm. And then this strange little novel called 1988 followed it up in 1995. And I just loved it at the time, and rereading it in the last little while, I'm still delighted by it for so many reasons, and a lot of them are really juvenile, and I think that's what's in the writing. So Praise was this huge hit. It was about Gordon, this young novelist wannabe working in a bottle-o, and his girlfriend Cynthia and the relationship they have. And it was called at the time grunge lit or dirty realism, and he hated that term reportedly, but it captured this wave that was around.
And it was
time.
Pretty grungy.
Yeah, you know, there's terrible hangovers and
bad sex,
dreadful sex, and I'm sorry to say, Kate, that does actually play quite a part in 1988 as well. So it's a prequel, and Gordon, who's yet to meet Cynthia, is still working in a Bottle-O in Brisbane and trying to write a novel. But he lives with a mate in this rundown house in suburban Brisbane, which is getting ready for Expo 88, which is quite funny. Anyway, eventually Gordon decides he's had enough. And another mate, Wayne, says, look, I'm going to go to Cape Don in the Northern Territory and man a lighthouse. Do you want to come for 6 months? And he's like, well, why not? So this is where the adventure begins. And off they go in Gordon's canary yellow Kingswood HZ sedan and drive from Brisbane to Darwin and then go to this lighthouse, which is so remote. It's on the tip of the Coburg Peninsula. So all around it is either the Arafura or Timor Sea, I'm not sure which. But then the land bridge is just hundreds of kilometres of dense scrub and bushland, so, you know, you'd never be able to make it on foot. So they're stranded there on this remote station, and then the madness begins to set in. They have to make these observations of weather every 3 hours throughout the day and night. And slowly, Gordon just goes insane.
And is that madness connected to the heat? I mean, so much, there's so much writing about the north of Australia in particular that connects heat and state of mind and this sense of both your body and all your edges being a bit fried.
Well, it's exactly that. But strangely, it's also the monotony. I'll just read a moment if I can. At some point, he's left alone on the island and he's really not sleeping. Day and night just don't mean anything anymore. And I'll just read you this bit. I contemplated abandoning the observations, at least the night ones. There was genuinely no need for them. Even the bureau back in Darwin could hardly have cared during the dry season. Night after night, the conditions were identical. No clouds, no wind, no real variation in temperature. It wasn't weather at all. But I couldn't do it. The observations represented order. They strung out one after the other. They were beacons. All I had to do was make it to the next one and I'd get by. So this is where he's really going mad. And one night on the way to the shack where the observation instruments are, he sees this giant green lizard. I'll just read you this. This is the bit that is so memorable. I stopped 10 feet short of the shack, swayed, stared. The door was blocked by a giant lizard. It was huge, a good 11 or 12 feet long. It was a dinosaur, mottled grey in the light spilling out from the shack, sinewy, ugly. It was up on its front legs, its mouth open, red tongue half out, eyes glaring at me. I glared back. What the hell was it? A big goanna? A monitor lizard? And on it goes. Anyway, he's basically in the peak of his madness. Then this guy turns up called Alan, and he's the chairman of the board from the local mob of the Gurig National Park. And he kind of asks Gordon a few questions and then says, listen, mate, you've got to come with me. And then later tells him, ah, there's big dreaming on that peninsula, big lizard dreaming. And so Gordon somehow has tapped into something else. And then Alan explains the dreaming of this area and how it affects the weather. So we have this order of these observations against this completely different understanding of the land that is given to Gordon by Alan. And that's what I've carried with me all these years since it came out in 1995. And it was such a pleasure to read it again.
And also a reminder, Cassie, that you are willing to read books that have novelists as protagonists.
Don't even start me.
So this one gets your tick of approval. But also interesting that it's partly about tabulating the weather and trying to control it and record it, because that's an issue in the book that I've selected for today.
Ah, you're adding The Weather Woman by Sally Gardner. Take us to Regency England.
Well, look, it begins at the very beginning of the 19th century, but it refers back in a way to older weather events. So in 1709, the River Thames froze, and that was one of the times referred to as the Great Frosts. And these happened a number of times, and they were so dramatic that the people of London actually went onto the river, they set up things called frost fairs. So these were real events. And of course, if you didn't know when the ice was going to melt, they could also be catastrophic events. So there's a sense of these things happening in the background to this novel. But it begins at the very beginning of the 19th century. And there's a little girl, and then we meet her as a young woman. Her name is Neva, and she can predict the weather. She can look at the sky and read the colours of it and the shape of it. And it's a bit, she sees patterns in the clouds, and it's described as a bit of a mixture of both science and magic. Now, for various reasons, she has been adopted by a man who's a clockmaker. Now, he sees her skill and they try to work out what to do with it. And she's a girl, so people are going to be sceptical of her skills. Remembering that this is in a period with the rise of natural sciences, which are known as natural philosophy, there's still a lot of religious belief in the country. So where would this knowledge sit? It would sit at this really uncomfortable juncture. And so this man, the clockmaker, thinks, well, what can we do with this knowledge? Neva wants it to be used for practical purposes. She wants to be able to warn sailors and make it easier for people who are working on the land. But they decide to make it a spectacle. So he creates an automaton, a metal moving figure that is the weather woman. And it performs for people who come and they ask the weather woman questions and she predicts the weather and she'll say, if you're sitting here at 9:20, it's going to start snowing and then it will stop by 9:45. So it's a whole performance, but the girl, Neva, is actually behind the scenes making it happen. It's a absolutely enjoyable read, but embedded in it is something very interesting, both about how we understand the weather and even about things like climate change, because they're seeing industry start to change the weather as well.
Mm-hmm. The Weather Woman by Sally Gardner. Let's turn to the final book that we'll discuss, and that's this brand new one. It is called Fed to Red Birds. It's a debut by Melbourne's Rain Collins. Now, Kate, it's got a first-person narrator.
Her name is Elva. She's a young Australian woman who's living in Iceland's capital, Reykjavik. She's studying Icelandic and she works in a shop called The Cabinet of Curiosities, and it's filled with bat skeletons and vintage surgical instruments and yellowed postcards of Edwardian porn, all of which, I should say, would have quite a place in The Weather Woman,
yes.
I think. These are very 19th century sort of objects. But in her spare time, Elva is learning taxidermy.
And she's also running from something in her past. We quickly learn that although she has an Australian father, she's also had this Icelandic mother who disappeared when she was a little girl. Is she in Iceland? We don't know. And this is part of the forward motion of the novel. Hannah Kent, first to you, there are parallels with your real life. I mean, you're from Australia and you went, as we've said, to Iceland as a teenager. Did you relate to Elva?
Yeah, there was so much that I did relate to in Elva. I mean, this is a young woman who has been completely enchanted by Iceland. She's intoxicated by the beauty of the language and its difficulty. And this, she has a real yearning, I think, to belong there, to find a place for herself there or make a place for her. And I related to all of that too. I think, you know, Elva is a character who is highly sensitive. You know, she's quite obsessive as well in myriad ways, as we find out. But her sensitivity, I think, really opens up the book to opportunities for these beautiful descriptions of you know, Iceland, the country, and also, you know, the quirks and curiosities and the cultural life of Reykjavik. And these were all aspects of the book that I really enjoyed and found both very familiar and also quite intensely evocative.
Yeah, we go there, don't we? It's full of ice and some blizzards and this black earth and volcanoes, but also white skies. And life is dominated by coming in and out of warm places into the cold. There's puffer jackets. But there's also a lot of mythology in it, and the sagas are there and the folklore beliefs and mystical
creatures, and Elva has these sentinels, which are strange little taxidermy creatures. Did we mention she's a taxidermist? Robbie, I wonder that intricate interior life she has, where she invests objects with a lot of power. How would you describe that?
Yeah, it is very mythological in some ways, and she has that deep connection to these totems she has, or the sentinels as she calls them, and the animals that she practices her taxidermy on become part of her life in a very real way, in perhaps most people wouldn't expect. And that's probably one of the things I enjoyed most about the book, as well as all the myths and folklore coming through. That was a really strong part of it. And her relationship with her grandfather, who wrote a best-selling children's book that is very based in the folklore of Iceland. And it was very appropriately dark, if that's the right way to say it. It just felt right for the setting. And I really enjoyed that aspect.
And that grandfather, his name is Affy. And although she's had a very close relationship with him, we learn fairly early on in the book that he has had a stroke. He's in a coma. She's not quite sure whether he's going to recover. And this book that he's written has also loomed very large in her life. There's also quite a sense of, I don't know, threat, menace, something sort of a gothic unease that is partly underlined, I think, by the snow and the cold, Cassie.
Yes, it permeates the rest of the novel too, just, I guess, because if you go outside and you make the wrong mistake, you know, that's it. They go on a bushwalk, they go on a hike into the ice, and there's a choice they've got to make about going an extra 600 metres, but it could mean the difference between life and death. So there is threat all the time in there.
But I'm glad that you accidentally called it a bushwalk, because yeah, we are aware of her as an Australian woman in Iceland, which means that she's not used to seeing a city that is transformed by the snow, and she's not even used to the way in which the very light changes. And so, Hannah, I'm wondering, you know, how well she got your sense of what happens to a city like Reykjavik in the winter.
There's so much of Reykjavik in this book. The location is another character, and I think Rain has done an amazing job of capturing, I mean, anyone who has been to Iceland or who longs to go or is planning a trip will recognise the landmarks, you know, the Sun Voyager sculpture, the hot dog stand, you know, Hallgrímskirkja, Mount Esja in the background. She doesn't really leave anything unmentioned in terms of the landmarks and all the things that Reykjavik is famous for. So I really enjoyed that aspect. I think she's absolutely nailed the weather. In fact, there was this one thing of coming in from the cold and needing to have a shower or something warm, and sort of almost the pain of the hot water, but also the smell of it. And I had completely forgotten about that sort of sulfuric stink of the showers, particularly in Reykjavik. So yeah, it brought back a lot of memories. It was lovely, actually. It was. I found it quite hard to read it objectively because I just kept on thinking about my own experiences most of the time.
Yes, I imagine that. And just as Elva feels at odds with Iceland, her mother, we learn, also felt out of place in the Australian landscape. So, you know, there's those high contrasts there again. It's called Fed to Red Birds, and it's by Rain Collins, and it's a debut.
And it's published by Simon & Schuster. What a lovely discussion of weather. I know there are many more books out there that everybody listening to this will be thinking of. Why didn't you talk about Sarah Moss's Summer Water, or why didn't you talk about Tara June Winch and the slap of the sun in The Yield? There are so many books we could add to our weather-filled, storm-tossed bookshelf. And of course, Cassie, we will list all of the books that have been mentioned on the bookshelf RN page.
Hannah Kent, Robbie Arnott, what an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for sparing us this time and reading for us.
Oh, it's been a joy. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Robbie Arnott and Hannah Kent. And for next month's book club, well, we're reading the work of Salman Rushdie, Cassie.
That's right. From Midnight's Children and Shame and the Satanic Verses right through to his latest, Victory City. So read along with us and share your insights.
Next time, a regular edition of The Bookshelf, we're reading Max Porter's Shy, Eleanor Catton's Burnham Wood, and Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya's Chain Gang All-Stars, which is a sort of adult Hunger Games with racial politics and corporations added. But that's it for this time. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.